Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition. Here we have of Crime and Science Radio. Tonight's guest is a very special guest called Bruce Mullahan, who we will be, Doug and Dan will be interviewing tonight, and we're trying to figure out what's going on with the music. I have no idea. I stop it and it just keeps going. So, without any further ado, though, as we figure out this technical taboo, because this is hilarious, and it should be over in a second. Let's hit it over. Welcome to the star of our shows.
I'm Stephen James.
Doug Lyle.
And I'm Susan May Warren.
And Jan Burke.
We're welcome, everyone. We're really happy to have Bruce Mullahan, the director of the Orange County Crime Lab in Santa Ana, California. Bruce has been with the County of Orange for 29 years, and he spent a good part of that working in the Orange County Crime Lab. He's now, as I said, directs it. That's one of the largest crime labs in the country. He's got over 130 forensic specialists working there, forensic scientists and support staff. And he's also he's been the president of the California Association of Crime Lab Directors, a member of the American Society of Crime Lab Directors, and he's currently participating with NIST on the Organization of Scientific Area Committees, which is a big part of the current work of the National Commission on Forensic Science, and I'm sure he'll be telling us more about that. So, Bruce, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. I'm looking forward to this. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, welcome, Bruce. Great to have you here.
I like the music intro, though.
Yeah, I thought that was great. John was going crazy. That's the best part. He's our technical guru, and it's thumped him, so I love it. Before we start talking about your career and science and forensic science and all of that, tell us a little bit about you, your background. I understand you grew up both in Southern California and in Japan.
I did, yeah. That was really, honestly, one of the best experiences of my life. My parents were missionaries. I spent a good portion of my childhood in Tokyo, and so we would alternate between Tokyo and Los Angeles. I was born in Los Angeles, and we would go back and forth between the two countries. But having the experience of, you know, living in a completely different culture like you have in Japan just opens your mind up so much to different ways of thinking, creative thought, opportunities. And it was just a fantastic experience, and it affected quite a bit about who I am as a person and some of the things I was interested in. Japan is a very technical country. They were in computers probably before we were, and most of the country is very tech-savvy, which affected a lot of what I do in my career now. But moving back and forth between those two cultures was something we did quite a bit.
Well, what interested you in science? When did that bug bite you, and then what did you do and study to prepare yourself for a career in science?
Yeah, you know, I don't know if I can think of a particular time when I all of a sudden started liking science. It was something that I was always drawn to. I tend to be a pretty curious person, and one of the great things about science is how it feeds that curiosity, looking at how things work, how the world is organized, and just finding out information was something that I've always been involved in. I think one of my favorite Christmas presents from my parents was a chemistry set. I don't know if you remember ChemCraft, but they were a company
that
actually
had one.
With what is now very, very toxic chemicals. Those are the kinds
exactly.
I played with. Yeah, no, it was great stuff. So, and you know, in Japan, I could buy a lot of the glassware and so forth. So I, you know, I turned that into a mini lab in my house. But that really, in fact, my parents had to tell me to go outside and play because I was playing with the chemistry set too much. But that is probably how it began. But really, all areas of science are things that are fascinating to me. Chemistry just happened to be what I spent most of my career doing. As I grew in my career, you know, you begin wanting to do things with purpose, and that's really how I got into forensic science.
Cool. Well, so how did that happen, though? Because I know you have a background and you studied in the hard science, so you really have a background in chemistry and physics and taught in those subject areas. But in my experience, at most universities, this is changing, but until very recently, we'll say, forensic science was not exactly a component of the curriculum. In fact, it wasn't always acknowledged as a true science by some scientists. So how did you become involved in forensic science itself?
Yeah, well, I could spend another 2 hours talking about what you just said. That was a really good question because
yes.
Most of the staff that we're hiring now usually have some kind of degree in biochemistry. That's the majority of our new hires. It's very difficult for us to hire hard science type people anymore. We haven't had a physics major hired in quite a while. We occasionally will get applicants who've been in chemistry, but obviously because of DNA, biochemistry is a big field. Most of our, we have two sides of the laboratory, which I can talk about later, but our field staff and our fingerprinting staff do typically have criminal justice backgrounds and a little bit more specific fields than just general science. But in my case, it was just a preference for the mathematical sciences that I enjoyed. Chemistry was a good balance, I think, because it's kind of, you know, in between these different areas of study. I enjoyed biology, but the memorization got to me a little bit. It was just very, I felt like I was grinding through just gross memorization sometimes. So biology was a bit more challenging to me. But the mathematical sciences is really where I started in. You know, by the time I graduated from high school and went into college, computers were just beginning. And the chemists and the physicists were actually able to use computational science very quickly, and that drew me in quite a bit as well. So those two things, I think, got me involved in science. Forensics, though, I did some graduate work at University of California, Irvine for about a year in the PhD program there, and the person who actually got me involved in forensics more than anybody else was Vince Ginn. He, or I should say Gwynn, he was a professor of forensic science there at UCI, even though they don't have a forensic science program now. But he did a lot of the work on Kennedy's assassination. So he tells the story of during Kennedy's assassination, the FBI actually cut out a piece of the curb and brought a piece of the curb where there were bullet fragments in the curb to UC Irvine for him to do elemental analysis. And so a lot of that work, and you know, that was a very Hooverish time.
Mm-hmm.
And in forensics, in criminal investigation, and brand new, very sparkly, very important. And so that, I think that enthusiasm that he had helped a lot with me, too.
Well, now, you mentioned UC Irvine, which is in the heart of Orange County, and I think our listeners may have an impression of Orange County, California, and that could have come from any number of television dramas, and more recently from some reality shows. So watching them, you might get the impression that everyone there is wealthy and white. So tell us about, I grew up there. I know Doug is also very, very rooted in the county. So tell us about the real demographics of the county you serve.
Yeah, Orange County is extremely diverse. Maybe it's not always published on television and in the media, but there's a very large Latino community, a very large Vietnamese community, a Middle Eastern community, a Chinese community. It's just extremely diverse. And one of the advantages or disadvantages, I guess, depending on how you look at it, because of our work, we're touching a lot of people's lives, and it's very cross-spectrum. And so it can be some very high-rent areas of Orange County, but it can also be some very densely populated areas. But in terms of the demographics, Orange County is very diverse. If there was probably one or two criteria that I would suggest is characteristic of Orange County, that would be work ethic. You know, most of the people in Orange County have an incredible work ethic. And it just seems like Orange County is always busy. And so it's, you know, a lot of people are driven. You know, there's a lot going on in Orange County in a very small geographic area. So you can drive from the north to the south. So, yeah, a lot more characteristic. But, yeah, it's grown. The demographics change very frequently and very quickly. Most of what we do is really more about, you know, the type of crimes. So it doesn't really affect us very much. But, yeah, Orange County isn't always necessarily the way it's pictured. Yeah, we don't all live in the beach. You know, we don't have these very, you know, wealthy homes. The beach is just a geographically smaller part of Orange County because it goes inland quite a bit as well. So.
And crimes do cross all ethnic groups.
They do.
All socioeconomic groups, all demographics you can think of. So what are some of the crimes in Orange County that you might not see in other counties, though? What's different about this place, or is there a difference between here and, say, L.A. or San Bernardino or some of the other counties that surround us here?
Yeah, I don't know if there's much of a difference. I think the numbers of each particular crime might be a little bit different. We're not as our population is not quite as dense as, for example, as some of the areas in Los Angeles. And so our homicide rate is not as high simply because of the population. We do have a little bit heavier property crime, residential burglaries. It's one of our higher priorities in Orange County. But I think if you talk to our crime scene staff, they would probably say it's the diversity that they notice the most. Because, you know, on one particular crime scene, you may be dealing with a very wealthy house in, say, Newport Beach with a particular crime that occurred. You may have a murder in South County, say, San Clemente, like we've had recently. But you also may be dealing with, you know, a gang shooting in a different area, or you might be dealing with a robbery at a mall. So the diversity of some of the scenes that we're actually going to see are quite varied in Orange County.
Now, your lab is connected with the Orange County Sheriff Coroner's Office. Can you tell us a little bit about them, how you work together, what the jurisdictional things are, and how that all coordinates and works?
Sure, that's another one-hour answer.
Yeah, exactly.
Orange County, we have a very vital and diverse and dynamic political climate in Orange County. My operational budget comes through the Sheriff Coroner Department, and primarily because we work very closely with investigating agencies. So the Sheriff Coroner, which Sandy Hutchins holds that particular title, so she operates as the sheriff and the coroner for Orange County. She is responsible for the unincorporated areas of Orange County, and she has the Sheriff Department has contract cities in Orange County that contract for Sheriff Department services. But we also have some very large police departments in Orange County. Santa Ana is a very large police department, Irvine PD, Fullerton, and some of the academic institutions themselves also have police departments. So I tell, you know, my clients that are people interested in forensics, one of the unique things about Orange County, and one of the things I really appreciate, is the diversity of law enforcement stakeholders that we actually get to work with. So we have police departments, the sheriff department, federal agencies that are working in Orange County will submit evidence to us. We work with the Department of Motor Vehicles, particularly with DUI cases. We're constantly talking to the district attorneys, not just in our testimonies on specific cases, but also in vertical prosecution types of situations where they may be working on, you know, certain types of crimes. But that dialogue of all these law enforcement agencies and the fact that we're the only real true full-service crime laboratory in Orange County allows us to have tremendous interaction with our clients and stakeholders. So Orange County really works with a type of synergy that you may not see elsewhere in the country. We're all talking very carefully. We don't, you know, our services are not really provided on a monetary basis. It's whatever the agencies need, whatever priorities we want to set as a group. That's why we can actually serve, you know, our stakeholders much better. That synergy is also very unique.
Well, I have to interject here that I hope everyone is not hearing my dog who's snoring really loudly right next to the phone here. So my apologies if that's coming over on
can't
the interview.
Hear it.
Oh, good. So it's distracting here, but we're good.
My cats might be meowing in a minute, so that's
All right, good. Well, tell us about the lab itself, what its current capabilities are, and some of the things that it may do that other labs may not do. How is it, you know, different? I know that no two crime labs are alike anywhere. That's something I've learned over the years, is they're very different, and that goes from everything from the leadership to the funding to just who they serve. So tell us about your lab.
Yeah. We call ourselves a full-service laboratory because we try to use every forensic tool that's available to us. But unfortunately, you know, sometimes our resources are limited, so we have to pick and choose you know, the types of forensic services that are more valuable than others. But for example, we don't really do full handwriting recognition or handwriting analysis as much as we used to at all. That's contracted out. There's a lot more useful tools like DNA, for example, in some of these documents. Gunshot residue, the residue left by guns, is something we do rarely. It's usually more valuable for us to swab a gun, for example, and look at the DNA that was left by touching a gun. But with some minor exceptions, we do provide almost every forensic service available. So obviously we have a full DNA lab. We've had a DNA lab ever since I was hired, really, in the late 80s. Full maturity, different types of services, full antemortem and postmortem toxicology. So we provide drugs in biological samples, both with individuals that are driving under the influence, for example, but also for the coroner's office. We assist them in their determinations of cause of death. Some of the things that are most important for us right now, we're looking at, obviously, there's a very big prescription drug and driving problem, not just in Orange County, but across the state. You know, alcohol has really leveled off over the past few years, but prescription drugs are more available, and there are a lot of people that are driving under the influence of these drugs, and this includes marijuana as well. You've probably heard about the legislation that is pending in the state. We're watching to see if marijuana becomes legalized next year. But the effects that that will have on driving under the influence will be huge in Orange County. We also provide unconventional trace services, which is fibers, explosives, ignitable liquids. We do a little bit of hair. Most of our hair analysis nowadays is just their DNA on the hair as well. We provide controlled substance services, so any type of drug or material that is assumed to be a drug can be sent to the laboratory for analysis. We have a full-service fingerprint facilities and laboratory, a very large and vibrant latent comparison unit. So our staff are experts in interpreting fingerprints, and comparing them, making conclusions, and actually searching them against what we call our automated biometric system, which includes fingerprints. And we also collect them at crime scenes, too. So most of the crime scenes we handle in Orange County are residential burglaries, property crimes. We respond to many of those along with the police departments. Our scientists will actually go out at homicides and officer-involved scenes as well to collect the evidence. Often we can do blood spatter, scene reconstruction, and of course photography in a lot of these cases as well. We have scene scanning devices that are useful in court, and of course I mentioned developing crime scenes for fingerprints. One other thing that's maybe unique about Orange County is that our CalID, or our biometric system, or fingerprint database, which is related to the state system, is integrated as part of the laboratory. So fingerprints are actually searched against this automated fingerprint system direct in the laboratory, so we're responsible for actually developing and maintaining this fingerprint database. And this is also growing into some other biometrics, facial recognition, tattoos, irises, and so forth sometime in the future. We have a very active firearms unit. We did a press conference earlier this year. We have a new three-dimensional bullet database that is used for correlations between bullets on cases that are assumed to be unrelated. And if you can hit these cases, you can actually associate guns from one crime to another. We also have a very active information technology unit. We write a lot of our own software. We do a lot of batching in Orange County for efficiency purposes, and we have a pretty active research and development unit, too.
Well, that's unusual, isn't it? That most crime labs don't get to do that much in the way of research and development. So
we don't. I wish we could do more of it. You know, it's one of those things where you have to balance a little bit of, you know, diversion, if I can use that term now, for a lot of gain later. A lot of our work, for example, in prescription drugs and driving is because of some of the great work that our staff are doing in developing methods that allow us to look for, you know, cross-spectrum prescription drugs in a very efficient way. But it does take time because your staff have to be taken off of casework and to do that method development. But then later on you get the benefits because over a long period of time you have these new methods. The fingerprint database that I mentioned was something brand new for not only California but the nation, correlating in 3D. So, yeah, we do this. There's this tension that goes on between needing casework to get out, researching things. Our DNA staff do this all the time where they're looking at new methods and technologies. DNA changes so frequently that it seems like there's always some research component with everything that we're doing. Yeah.
Well, that is a good segue to my next question, which is, you know, you've worked for the lab for a long time. So how has the lab changed over those years?
Yeah, that's another good question. When I started, the lab was only about 25 people, if memory serves. So obviously we've grown quite a bit. We grow in these spurts, I think. So we'll have a really large hiring. We'll hire maybe 10 people, and then we'll not be able to hire anybody. So the budgets in Orange County sometimes fluctuate. And we're in a stage right now where the people that were hired in the late 80s are just beginning to retire. And so you get these waxes and wanes, of course, in the staffing. But certainly the number of people that we've hired because of the number of cases has gone up is significant. We do a lot more automation than when I first started. Everything was very manual at the time. So you had maybe one case, you were looking at every single piece of evidence, and it was a piece-by-piece type of analysis. We had instruments, but the instruments were also very manual. You were always with them. So most of the people were in the laboratory all the time working on each of these steps of the analysis. We have a lot more automation now, so you'll find most of our staff at their desks working on a computer with the digital results than you will standing in front of the instruments, which are mostly automated. There's a lot more accreditation, auditing, scrutiny, regulation than when I started. I think really when you began, you had an internal training program. You just needed to make sure that you were doing things scientifically, and then the results were output. Now, really everything that we do is scrutinized 6 or 7 different ways, which is a good thing, but it means there's a lot of paperwork and a lot of examination on everything that actually happens in the laboratory. So much more scrutiny, checks and balances and so forth. A lot higher expectations, too. Probably the biggest change, though, was the CSI TV shows. So there were no TV shows except maybe Quincy and some peripheral stuff that you may have had with Dragnet and some fingerprinting stuff. But when these TV shows came out, and I think Quincy was one of the first ones that really made a difference, it changed the dynamic of what we actually do. People began to get interested. Hey, maybe there's something to this. So.
Well, just as your lab has changed, and most labs have, the forensic science has changed, obviously, dramatically. I mean, it's a relatively new field anyway. But there's been an explosion in changing, especially in the last 30, 40 years, things that have come along. Let's look at technologies first. What are some of the most promising newer technologies that you see now that you think will become very, very important as the years go by that we're looking down the road?
I think there's probably two sides of this. One is making things a little bit more efficient. So the normal basic processes that we're doing, a lot of these are chemical. With automation, computational capabilities, the speed at which these instruments work. So we can do things usually a lot better, a lot quicker. Some of the newer technologies are, of course, in DNA. I'm sure you or your readers have, or listeners, I should say, have read a lot or written a lot about DNA and some of the technologies that are actually used. And it has changed constantly over the last 20 years. I think one of the newer technologies that's coming on that we're looking at from the sidelines right now, but it's something called next-generation sequencing. I think they're changing it to massive parallel processing, something like this. But what it allows you to do is look at a much larger portion the DNA molecule. And so it could allow you to begin developing predictions of certain genetic characteristics, something we can't do now, right? Our DNA is designed to look at areas of the DNA molecule that are non-coding for parts of you, your hair color, your eye color, and that kind of thing. But with next-generation sequencing, there's the potential that with some debate, of course,
right,
that you could theoretically predict the hair color, the eye color, the height of an individual. Obviously very controversial, but the way the technology has advanced is opening up a lot of this. Biometrics are probably going to be a much bigger service provided. Fingerprints have really been the majority of the biometric work that's been done in the past, but face, like I mentioned, iris, tattoos, voice, both for comparing individuals. Let's say you're booked for committing a crime, and then you're released or you serve your time, you come back later and are booked again, making sure we're identifying the same person can be done with not just fingerprints anymore, but facial recognition and possibly even DNA. But this also could be, an investigatory tool. If you have a video from a robbery, let's say, you can look at the face in the video and start comparing it against databases. Some of the other technologies, of course, are how many drugs we can look at the same time, automated systems. Toxicology is reaping the benefits of this quite a bit right now because the instruments are designed in a way that you can look at a broad spectrum rather than having to focus on an individual drug. But most of the dialogue, I think, in the next 5 years is going to be about pattern recognition, and some of this involves artificial intelligence too. So shoe prints, tire tracks, fingerprints, the markings left on bullets and so forth, all of these are really at the core of forensic science, because we've been dealing with pattern recognition. Usually you have an unknown sample or a suspect sample, and you have something that's retrieved from a crime scene. So your expertise and the science that you actually use for comparing those two is a big part of what we do. But what the academic community is asking us to do in the next few years is develop mathematical models, very similar to what the fingerprint databases do, for understanding how significant and unique those are. So the modeling of this pattern recognition disciplines that we actually do is something that's going to dominate our conversations, I think, for 4 or 5 years.
Well, along the lines of technology, let me ask you a couple of things. One of the questions I always get is, how long does it take to do a DNA analysis? And I always answer, well, it depends on backlog, it depends on the staffing, it depends on the jurisdiction, it depends on the sophistication of the lab. Where are you talking about? So let me ask you, in your circumstance, in your lab, when a lab technician, your DNA analyst, gets a specimen in front of it, how long does it take them to generate a profile once they plug it in the system and it comes out?
Yeah, for most of our work in DNA, it's between 2 weeks to a month for most cases. That's simply because we do batch our samples. We do
Sure. We do
things in group, of course. There's a lot of economies of scale that you get by not just doing one sample at a time, of course. The actual work itself, we can drop everything, work on one or two samples, and get it done in 8 hours.
Yeah.
And that's even with review, but that's a lot of work.
Yeah.
So the physical limitations really are about the number of cases that we have and working all those cases together. But, 2 to 3 weeks, which is pretty routine for some of our easier samples. If we have very complicated mixtures or a lot of samples in a case, for example, where we have to make sure we protect suspect samples from victim samples and so forth, which would give it more of a month.
Right.
Orange County is pretty quick, we owe that to the batching system set up by our staff and how they manage the case flow. Most areas of the country are probably 3-4 months for most cases. Property crimes, usually just simply because of the volume, take a little
exactly.
bit longer as well. But,
But the other thing, I've read a lot lately about the ability to distinguish identical twins. And I know using single nucleotide and some of the other newer technologies out there, is this something you guys are involved in now? Is this something do you see that's actually working? Because identical twins obviously have always been a problem as far as DNA analysis.
Yeah, we don't do it now. We are watching it.
Right.
It's forensics is very opportunistic. You know, one of the things that attracted me to it was the variety and how you'll use almost everything at your disposal. You're not simply focusing on one particular technique. But it also means that you have to take a back seat sometimes to see how things go.
Right.
And a little bit more of a cautious approach, because the work we're doing is so critical. We're dealing with people's lives, and so we have to make sure that the science supports it. We love R&D. You know, we love implementing brand new things, but when you're dealing with people's lives in court, you have to make sure that what you're doing is fully validated,
yeah,
and understood and accepted by the scientific community. So we have to kind of take this backseat approach. But we have talked about it, and we are looking at it, but nothing actively now.
Which is a perfect segue, as you would say, to the other question. Forensic science has changed, and you know, many are now pointing the finger and saying, well, it's not so scientific after all. You know, I've always got my back up about that a little bit. It's not the science that's the problem. But in some circumstances it is, but in most circumstances it's the human element. What do you see? Is this criticism real? Is it valid? What do you see as the major problems in people saying that, you know, forensic science, many of the techniques have not been scientifically worked out?
Yeah, I think, you know, my world has been really Orange County. I'm aware of what's going on nationally, so I've been spoiled, because Orange County has always been very conservative with what we do. Our opinions are always couched with context as much as possible. We understand our limitations very well. We try to be very transparent about it. I don't know if the criticism is inappropriate, though. I think as long as you're not, you know, sweeping broad strokes and saying all forensics is bad, and you're asking for forensics to demonstrate why the conclusions are appropriate, or show the background about why you're doing something a certain way, or show the scientific foundation for what you're doing, those are highly appropriate questions when you're dealing with very complicated and very important work like we do. It's, I think, when the dialogue turns into these broad strokes that forensics is not science, I think that is where I think they're speaking out of turn, because, you know, forensics is really about using scientific techniques, but you're applying an expert to this, and the expert has training, the expert has backgrounds, and so it is important that you separate the hard objective science from the benefit that the expert can give in a courtroom, in terms, especially in terms of interpretation, and then understand the limitations of all this. So, you know, publishing that scientific foundation is extremely important. This is what a lot of the national dialogue is right now, is making sure we have standard definitions of where things come from, why we have this technique, is it accepted in the community, and all that's wholly appropriate with the work that we're actually doing. I'm a little uncomfortable, though, when, you know, these are these gross generalizations that forensics is bad, because it's really not true. Forensic science is really the science that everybody else is doing. It's just we do a lot more different types of science in one place than most people do. You know, we're not a toxicology lab per se. We're not a DNA lab per se. We're actually everything. And so we use these techniques holistically on the cases and in court and so forth.
Good answer. Great answer, actually.
Yeah, I think one of the things, just to kind of pull up a little bit on that, is that all of science challenges science. It's the nature of science to challenge what's been believed. And so it's inevitable, at least in my mind, that there will be things that, as we learn more, will challenge what we believed about them in the past. And it's not a bad thing. It's not, naturally, if it's affected somebody's liberty, you would want to go back and review those cases, but it doesn't mean that anyone had ill intent involved in there.
Oh yeah, there have been jurisdictions across this country, I think, which have stretched the capabilities of certain forensic techniques. Though, I mean, this is something that the academic or the forensic community has known about for a while, and actually tried to move us in different directions. I mentioned gunshot residue. Gunshot residue is not one of those areas, you know, if you fire a gun, residue from the primers on the bullets can sometimes be deposited on your hands. But, and we've used this for years, and the technique is not necessarily wrong.
Right.
It's just that it's extremely limited in how you interpret it. And so we generally don't like doing it because of how it's misinterpreted. So if we, you know, if we were testifying in court, we would say, yeah, gunshot residue can be deposited on the hand. It's possible. Well, what does it mean if you find it? It means, I don't know. They could have been around a gun that was fired. They may have fired it. It could have come maybe from a different source. Now, we don't always get a chance to explain in court the whole context of these things, and that's important, so you understand the limitations. So we've moved away from a lot of these techniques because they can be misinterpreted a lot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, what do you wish the public understood about forensic science?
Well, it's not as fast as television. I don't think we don't usually do things in 1 hour. It would be nice. We don't usually interview suspects ourselves. My staff told me that I'm not as good looking as the people on television are. But, you know, it's. But I will say it really is an incredible job. Not just the variety and how fun the job is, but it really is a job with purpose. I mean, you know, as I mentioned, you're dealing with people's lives. You're dealing with a segment of our society where people have made some huge mistakes. But there's you know, two sides to forensic science. We go to great lengths not to be biased. And so we say that we're advocates for evidence, certainly not for the prosecution or for the defense. So forensic science can just as easily exonerate somebody or help exonerate with the evidence that we interpret as it can, giving evidence that may help the jury convict an individual. So, you know, when you enter forensic science, you're it's not just a career. It's really a life that you're choosing to make a difference in the community that you actually live in. It is very challenging. You can be grilled on a witness stand quite heavily. Our staff don't always find it pleasant, but they understand how important it is, and we would not ask really for anything different. We have a lot more, most people don't realize, partly because of television, we have a lot more accountability than is published too. So I've mentioned how many audits we go through, how many reviews we go through. You know, before a report leaves the laboratory, it's probably gone through 3 or 4 different types of reviewing or viewing by individuals, technical review, administrative review, and, you know, most laboratories now are accreditation or going through accreditation or they have been accredited. And so there's a lot of auditing and scrutiny about what happens before you can come up with the result. So when you hear, you know, on television that a crime has been committed and it will take X number of weeks for a result to come back from the laboratory, it's because of this, you know, this process that we go through to making sure that what we say is correct and vetted and appropriate for the legal system. And that part of it is laborious at times, but important. The public doesn't always see that, you know, because they've seen the final result.
Mm, yeah. Well, let's talk about your job specifically as the director of the lab. What are your responsibilities, and what is a typical day like for you?
The short answer is I don't know. I'm not in the lab. Some days I wonder what I'm doing. I miss being in the laboratory.
You had so much confidence up until now.
Well, you know, the people, if I can paraphrase Colin Powell, the people really doing the work are the people that are in the laboratory analyzing the samples. They're the ones that sign the reports. They're the ones that are testifying in court. I don't get to do any of that anymore. But a typical day for me is dealing first with or working with our clients and stakeholders. So our law enforcement clients, the district attorneys, people that work with budgets, the Board of Supervisors is very actively involved with the laboratory, of course, because a lot of the work that we do is very political. So it's I call it a dance. There's this, you know, a creative tension that goes on with all of our stakeholders, making sure that priorities are adjusted, that we can use the resources appropriately. Orange County is very positive in that we work very well together, but it can be very challenging sometimes to make sure that these priorities get balanced. Now, we have very bright staff at the laboratory. I mean very bright staff. These are not just people that have advanced degrees and have done very, very well in school. These are individuals that have gone through background checks. They've gone through, you know, constant training. They're very strong personalities and such that they can, you know, withstand testimonies. And so when you're dealing with people this bright, this complicated, this intelligent, and this driven, there's a lot of conflict, and it's not necessarily bad conflict, but there's a lot of disagreements. So I spend a lot of my time trying to make sure that we're steering our conversations appropriately, at the same time making sure that, you know, they're heard. And that could be very, very interesting sometimes. Sometimes the emotions can run high. Sometimes we do things so quickly and so fast and so beneficially to Orange County that it's just, you know, incredibly rewarding. But it, if I had to give you two answers, though, that I would really like to say, I hope that I get a chance to actually provide creative solutions for Orange County, because I see really my major role is providing vision and providing solutions to some of the problems that we have. You know, we're constantly dealing with resource issues, whether it's just money or availability of space or whatever. So providing solutions in a constrained context is something that's a constant struggle. But preparing for the next 5 to 10 years, you know, if you're preparing for next year as a lab director, you're probably behind the curve. You have to be thinking 5 and 10 years ahead, because it will just catch you so unaware if you're not careful. So that's kind of an ethical duty, really, I have.
Well, our listeners love stories. They love case histories and stuff. Can you tell us about some of the fun, unusual, informative cases that you've kind of worked on?
Sure, I can give you a couple that I worked on. Some of our more interesting ones are from other staff in the laboratory. We had a fingerprint ID from a photograph. There was a camera that was left at a crime scene by the individuals who committed the crime, and a photo was obtained, and one of the officers actually asked if we could blow up the finger, so our staff blew up the finger, and we were actually able to trace the fingerprint. We were able to get a hit. Identify the suspect just from a digital photo.
Wow.
That was really a lot of fun.
That's great.
Yeah. We had a, it wasn't one of my cases either, but we had a DNA case a few years ago where a suspect was shooting an officer. The officer returned fire. The bullet passed through the fatty area around this individual's waist, and the bullet lodged in a wall. The suspect jumped the wall and got away. Our staff were able to pull the bullet out of the wall, wash it, and get DNA. And we were able to search in the database and actually identify the suspect just from the bullet passing through the suspect's waist. One of the probably the most influential cases for me was really the first homicide case I did. I was very young at the time, working in toxicology, and I was asked to prove whether some blood spots on the pants of the victim had heroin in it. It was a very simple process, but I had no idea what to expect when I got to the case, because it was a very highly published case or publicized case in the 80s. Courtroom was very large and very full, very professional attorneys. I got there really not knowing what to expect, but the case, two individuals killed this young girl, and they were later convicted. Their story was that they were actually shooting drugs with this girl, and that they were, you know, playfully kind of squirting the blood mixed with heroin with a syringe, and that's how the blood, their blood actually got on her pants. And so my job was just simply to show if there was no heroin, for example, in that blood. We didn't have DNA at the time. But my role was very, very small in this case, but the attorneys were very good. I was called an idiot directly on the stand. I have no idea, Mr. Bland. You have no idea what you're saying. That was the last thing that was actually said. I think the prosecuting attorney was just as upset with me the defense attorney was, because he could not get the information that he needed in the case. You know, it really was where the rubber met the road with me, because immediately I understand the consequences of the work that I was actually doing, as naive as I was. Another one of my cases, I think the first pattern case I worked on was a sexual assault case where a petroleum jelly type lubricant was actually used. There was a green stain on the panties of the victim, and the suspect actually had a tin of this petroleum jelly in his backpack. And so my job was actually to see, you know, were they the same petroleum jelly. And I don't remember what the outcome of the case was, and all I could really show is that they were consistent, and you hear this a lot in forensic science. You know, they were not distinctly different necessarily, but they were consistent, could have been. But as is typical in forensics, you know, you become an expert on the evidence of that particular case. So I actually went out and bought as many different types of petroleum jelly as I could find. So you come back with about 30 different types from all these drugstores, and you begin learning, and you begin learning everything there is to learn about petroleum jelly, and you become an expert on petroleum jelly. We had another individual in our trace section that did a Ziploc case in South County, and he became an expert on how Ziplocs were actually manufactured. And one of the great things about forensics. In this case, there were some antibiotics, which was a little unusual for that time. This was something pre-Neosporin, if I remember correctly, but it had a green tint to it, and it was an antibiotic, or I should say a petroleum jelly from Mexico, which had antibiotics, which was a little unusual. So that helped a little bit in the case. But, yeah, you, like I said, you become experts in whatever type of evidence you're working
on. I can see you sneaking from store to store
kind of
in the vice squad following you around.
well, you want to go to as many different drugstores as you can. But,
exactly. Yeah. We don't know what he's doing, but this can't be legal.
It occurs a lot more often than you might think. We've done this with gasoline. You don't want to know what kind of samples our staff ask from the other employees, you know, as examples to work with. So, yeah.
Well, because this is such a fun field, what advice do you have for people who think they want to work in this arena?
Yeah, good for them. It's an incredibly rewarding job. Boredom is one of the things that bothers me a little bit, but this job is never boring. Every single day in this job is different, but it is also incredibly rewarding because you are actually really making a true difference in people's lives by the work that you do. So while our salaries may not necessarily be as high as other areas, every day when you leave the job, you realize that you made a difference. And the people are looking at you for the truth. They are looking at you for ethical behavior. They're looking for responsibility. And that responsibility that you have with people's lives is very sobering. It can be challenging. I mean, in addition to the required education that you have to have, a very good understanding of science, obviously. But I think that more important than that is pay attention to the kind of person that you are. We are not just looking for people with really good common sense who can adapt to situations in addition to just the basic science. We're looking for people that have a pretty good moral center. I mean, you know that we go through background checks, and these background checks can be very serious and very taxing, and you have to decide very early in your life if you want to go into this field, because the choices you make when you're very young are going to impact your ability to get into this field. But once you get into it, it's probably one of the most rewarding jobs you can have.
Well, in our last few minutes here, I'll have to ask on behalf of those in our own field, listeners who are writers, if they want to find out more about forensic science or a particular lab, how can they do that without driving the members of the lab nuts?
Yeah. Well, you know, actually, most of our staff would love to talk to the writers. We love writers because it adds a lot of color to the work that we do. One of the first breakfast meetings I went to at a seminar was Patricia Cornwall. So there are some really good forensic science writers right now. But most laboratories will do tours. We do tours for the public right now. There is a tremendous amount of information on the web. Most forensic organizations, like the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, the American Society of Crime Lab Directors, California Association of Crime Lab Directors, and California Association of Criminalists and Toxicologists and so forth. There's a lot of information on the web that you can actually research. I think a lot of the seminars that are held nationally, too, are good places to attend. American Academy of Forensic Sciences is the one that moves around quite a bit, and they're the ones that has a much broader and type of stakeholder groups. They have writers that actually have a good presence at these meetings. There are odontologists or dentists that have presence, and so their interaction with the forensic scientists is a little bit broader than you might find at a normal meeting.
Well, we are down to our last minute here, so I'm just going to ask real quickly, what's on the horizon for the Orange County Lab?
Well, a lot of changes legally, I think. We're looking at marijuana driving, as I mentioned, next year, a very big part of what we're doing. The advantages of DNA technology with investigations, not just prosecution, is important. The biometrics that we're dealing with are growing quite a bit. And there's going to be a very, very large federal dialogue, even growing much more than it already is, with forensic science. A lot of it will be good. A lot of it will be challenging for us. So we're going to be challenged to actually talk a lot more about what we do and making sure that the nation actually knows how important forensic science really is.
Well, we really want to thank you for joining us tonight. We'd love to have you back sometime to talk with us more about all of that federal stuff, which is going huge in this field. But thank you so much. We know you're very busy. Thanks for giving us your time.
Absolutely. My pleasure. I enjoyed talking to you.
I know our listeners love this. Thank you.
I've enjoyed it. Okay.